Today, performative politics won't solve the housing crisis. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news. Well, we've now had the fallout from the round table last week, and I am pretty disappointed, but not really surprised, that we've got very little to show for it. Just to recall, of course, we have a major issue with regard to housing price relative to income or medium home price compared to capacity to pay. And as a result, it's harder and harder for people to get into the housing market. This article the other day highlighted the fact that it takes now four times as long to scrape up a deposit as it did in the 1970s. And comparing 29 weeks from 1975 to 121 weeks in 2025, if you can do it. And for many people, of course, it's even worse than that. So the round table on productivity really didn't do much to change the story about housing affordability. But of course, it was a big public event. And therefore, from a performative perspective, you could say, well, they're doing something, aren't they? Because they're meeting and talking about it. But are they really doing much at all? Now, just in passing, this article really summed it up quite well, insofar that the conversations were a bit all over the place. Of course, Chalmers did open the door on an assault on superannuation concessions and other wealth taxes in exchange for lower income tax, or maybe not, but declared an intergenerational equity issue, which, of course, we've been talking about for some long time. I'm not sure they're going to solve it. Interestingly, of course, they also are still pushing for lower taxes for companies, particularly smaller ones, and the Productivity Commission report on the tax rate of 20% for businesses with turnover under $1 billion. There was a lot of discussion also about the housing question. Well, they really got, in the end of the day, to talk purely about the various nuisance tariffs more broadly, but also the National Construction Code. But of course, the code is there for a reason. And the question is, well, is the code adequate? Does it work? And is somehow changing it going to make much difference at all? Well, my perspective is changing the code is not necessarily going to do much at all. It may or may not speed up building, but there are many other questions that need to be thought about. And as this article highlights, the outspoken Labour backbencher Ed Husic warned the Albanese government's proposal to pause the National Construction Code is misguided and against homeowners' interest, while welfare groups say a prolonged freeze could lead to higher power bills. Now, it's interesting to note that the pause would not necessarily apply to essential elements of the code that affect building safety and quality, but it could well involve standards such as energy efficiency standards and mandatory electric vehicle charging. And there was evidently widespread agreement that the code was too complex. And the pushback, of course, was also that this could lead to higher energy charges later. And I make also the point that there was discussion here about EVs and also the road user levy, which Matt Cummins from the CBA described as being pretty uncontroversial in principle. And Ken Henry said, fantastic, let's do it, according to people who were in the meeting. Now, when it comes to the building code, I want to highlight that there are already significant issues with the building code. And in fact, this ABC article makes really interesting reading. They say Australia might be a sunburnt country, but research says that paradoxically, the nation's reputation for summer warmth is likely one of the reasons why so many homes feel cold during winter. A new study by the Adelaide-based Australian Centre for Housing Research found that more than 80% of the homes surveyed across five temperate states failed to meet a World Health Organization minimum recommendation for winter warmth. The finding is based on a sample of 100 homes in New South Wales, South Australia, Tasmania, Victoria, and Western Australia, where residents were sent sensors to track household temperatures last winter. We posted them data loggers, so temperature sensors, and we instructed them on where to place them and how to set them up, co-author Lindrell Daniel told ABC Radio Adelaide. Then we asked them to post them back so we could look at the data. So it was really a citizens' science approach. Dr. Daniel, who's a specialist in architecture, said homes were not built for cold weather because of the widespread perception of Australia as a sun-drenched country. Researchers wanted to see how often and how many homes were below 18 degrees Celsius. That's a benchmark defined by the World Health Organization as a safe and well-balanced indoor temperature. That's when we start to see the health effects of being in cold temperatures kick in, Dr. Daniel said. Of the 100 homes, 81 recorded average temperatures below 18 degrees Celsius, including one home in Tasmania, where averages were just 10.9 degrees centigrade over the three winter months of 2022. According to the findings, which were published in the Journal of Energy Research and Social Science, winter indoor temperatures averaged just 16.5 degrees across all of the 100 homes. The findings were consistent across the income spectrum also, and the researchers suggested that one of the reasons that homes are so cold was because of the perception that Australia is a warm climate country. We haven't really required or mandated that our homes are super insulated and protect us from weather like our Northern Hemisphere counterparts, said Dr. Daniel, who's an associate professor in architecture at the University of South Australia. And to note that Virginia Traoli wrote recently that the coldest that she'd ever been was the four winters that she lived in Sydney. Well, she came from Melbourne. Now, I had the same experience. I moved to Australia in 1994. In fact, we rented an apartment on Sydney Harbour. It was at Kirribilli and it looked out over the beautiful city of Sydney and the bridge. But this apartment was the coldest place that I'd ever lived in. It got no sun at all during the winter months. And we ended up having to splash out on fan heaters just to try and get by. Compared with my experience in the UK, it was incredibly cold. And here's the point. The standards that we have for building and construction in Australia aren't great. They actually don't cover enough when it comes to dealing with the cold. And of course, that means that people have to spend a lot more on heating their homes in the winter months, which is very energy inefficient. And as Traoli actually said in her article, many homes in Australia were built before insulation was required by law. And even after regulations were introduced, the minimum standards here are lower than in Europe or North America. In Victoria, mandatory insulation only started in 1991, and national minimum energy standards were not set until 2003. Poor air tightness and a lack of focus on thermal efficiency makes our houses colder. We build timber-framed suburban homes like the US, but unlike them, most of our homes have poorer insulation and single-pane windows. US homes are generally more airtight and energy efficient, and UK homes are usually brick or masonry, making it easier to retain internal heat. Australian homes are also some of the largest in the world, making them harder and more expensive to heat. It's worth, of course, also remembering that whilst most of the air cons installed across Australia will be reverse cycle, but of course, anybody from the Northern Hemisphere will tell you, heat rises. So those high-set aircon units are keeping the ceilings beautifully warm while you reach for that puffer jacket when you sit on the couch and watch TV. Which takes us to the announcement over the weekend, because the federal government is moving to speed up decisions on housing approvals and limit further changes to the lengthy National Construction Code, just days after being urged to do so by the Economic Reform Roundtable. Once this year's scheme updates to the 2,000-page National Construction Code are finalised, further changes will be paused until the middle of 2029, excluding anything related to essential safety and quality. The next round of changes to the code were due in 2028. The decision means any further changes to improve energy efficiency or environmental impacts will be paused for at least a year. During the pause, the government will consider taking further steps to help traders navigate the code, including by using AI, and also consider moving from the regular reviews of the code every 3 months to a longer cycle. It's too hard to build a home in this country, Housing Minister Claire O'Neill said. During this year's election campaign, Labour criticised the coalition's promise to freeze the National Construction Code for 10 years. Amid a housing crisis and a quest to decarbonise, some Australians are asking how much space they really need to live well. Separately, Environment Minister Murray Watt said he would fast-track decisions on applications before his department to build more than 26,000 new homes. The move doesn't guarantee approvals will be granted, only that decisions will be made more quickly. Fast-track projects will continue to be required to meet all environmental requirements, Senator Watt said. But the fast-track decisions will incentivise developers to provide required information up front. The government also says it's taking further action on other suggestions offered by the roundtable, including reducing barriers to more superannuation investment in housing supply, encouraging further uptake of modern methods of construction, including prefabrication, and working with the states to accelerate approvals. So here we have it. At the end of that three-day love-in, what we have is minor tweaks to the approvals process and the standards, which aren't particularly effective and don't necessarily cover the right things when it comes to warmth in winter, being frozen. So, to my mind, this is merely performative politics in action. There's very little here that's going to change much at all. It certainly won't address housing affordability. And, of course, no discussion about migration and dialing it down and some of the other things that we touch on regularly, including the costs of energy. So anybody who might have thought that this last 3 days was useful, I think are kidding themselves. It will give the government a free pass to play around with superannuation, which of course is what they really wanted to do, and other tax reforms. But when it comes to solving the housing crisis, it'll do nothing at all. The trouble is, we have built this problem over 30 to 40 years, and the government still doesn't want to address the fundamental issues that they have responsibility for. This is performative politics in action, polished, but a little more than a turd. Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high, price discovery and price transparency are hard to find, and then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot Ribbon an email at info@ribbonproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.